Welcome to the RevUp Dental podcast. My name is Nick Fotash, the founder of RevUp Dental. And in this episode, we're going to explore the critical mistakes you want to avoid for successful practice acquisition. We're going to explore the pros and cons between buying an existing practice versus starting a new one from scratch. We'll also look at the do's and don'ts of acquiring a new practice, the details you want to look at, the questions you want to ask, the common mistakes and pitfalls that dentists make when acquiring a practice, and many other aspects that will be critical to your success as a dental practice owner. Our guest on this podcast is Jennifer Blair from Tier 3 Brokerage, a division of Henry Schein. Jennifer has well over a decade of experience in helping dentists successfully buy and sell dental practices. She's seen the good, the bad, and the ugly when it comes to acquisition and sale of dental practices, and she has a wealth of information to share, including tips on buying a practice, costly mistakes to avoid, understanding the legal aspects of a purchase, and much more. I hope you enjoyed this episode, and if you do, please consider leaving us a like, a share, maybe even a comment, as this engagement helps us tremendously in reaching and helping more dentists just like you. Thank you for listening. Okay, so let's start. So welcome, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. I think this topic is going to be an interesting one because from our side, you know, what we've seen is, you know, at RevUp Dental, we work with like hundreds of different dentists. And every week we get contacted by, you know, a dentist who bought a practice somewhere or they started a practice and they're super excited. You know, they built a really nice office. It's got like all the bells and whistles. And they come to us and they're like, I just need the patients now. You know, everything's set up. You know, it's a beautiful office, beautiful signage. I've got the latest equipment. It's state of the art. I just need people through the door now. And what they don't realize is sometimes they've really dug themselves into a hole and they don't even realize it. You know, having worked with hundreds of offices, you start to see like, you know, you have a better idea of like kind of what it takes to grow a practice, especially if you're starting one from scratch. And we've seen a lot of situations where I feel like, you know, people make a lot of mistakes when buying an office or when starting an office. And we wish we can kind of reach them earlier in that process, because by the time they come to us and they're looking for sort of like someone to pull a rabbit out of a hat, you know, like the results they're hoping to see, the amount of patients they want to drive, the time frame they want to see those results in, and the budget they think it's going to take to do that is, you know, wildly optimistic. And hopefully with this webinar, what I want to get across to people is, here's the types of questions or criteria that you should be looking at when you're deciding whether you should purchase something or start something up. Because a lot of dentists that we've spoken with who, you know, are just early on in their career, when we ask them like, well, what made you buy this practice or what made you start in this area? Honestly, I've never heard really good answers. I've never heard someone sit down and say like, well, I looked at these particular metrics. Here's how I looked at the demographics. Here's how I looked at the competition. Here's how I analyzed the financials. A lot of these decisions are made kind of in a sort of misguided way. And, you know, the repercussions of that don't become apparent for, you know, months or years later, you know, that they kind of like dug themselves into a hole and it's really hard to get them out of there. I'm hoping that in today's talk, we can, you know, have, you know, get more ways to sort of evaluate a purchase and sort of like talk about some critical mistakes that people make that can really slow them down in their career. Like really, you know, they don't realize they bought like a really difficult practice to grow. So our guest tonight, we've got Jennifer Blair. I'm going to give you sort of the professional introduction to let you know a little bit about who Jennifer is. So having started her career working for a major dental equipment supplier, then serving dental professionals at a major bank, followed by over 15 years as a prior partner and now transition consultant at Tier 3 Brokerage, Jennifer has a wealth of experience in the dental industry. Her expertise in valuations and practice sales has allowed her to assist hundreds of clients in maximizing their value and planning for a successful transition. With a project management background, she is with you every step of the way from initial discussion to practice valuations to the eventual sale and transition. So thank you so much, Jennifer, for taking the time to talk to us.
I'm excited to be here.
Fantastic. So I want to start off with, you know, probably one of the most important questions with the decisions that dentists have to make. Do you buy an existing office? Do you instead, you know, build your own practice?
obviously, to some extent, this really depends. It depends on what your goals are, depends on where you're looking to open. Is there anything even available for sale? But I want to talk about sort of from your side, the sort of the pros and cons of, you know, how you should think about this. And before I do that, I want to pull up a poll here, just because before you give them the answers, I'm curious to see, you know, what do people think? Do you think if you're, let's say you're an associate, you finished school, you've been an associate for a couple of years, you're looking to branch off on your own, you want to be a business owner, do you think it's better to buy an existing practice and, you know, kind of ramp it up from there? Or is it better to just start fresh, build your own office from scratch and do things the way you think makes sense right from the very start? So let me put the poll up here. Okay, so most people are saying it's actually better to buy an existing practice. Mm-hmm. Some, it's evening out a little bit. Some of them believe making a startup is a better decision. Some of them are not really sure. So I'll let people keep voting, but you know, Jennifer, take the stage. So what do you think? What are the sort of the pros and cons? How should you think about this?
I mean, from our perspective, obviously we're sales reps. We sell dental practices for a living. So it may be a bit biased from my end, but obviously we think it's much better to buy an existing practice than to start up a new one. The reasons for that are really quite simple. You're buying into a practice that already has an existing patient base, staff that are trained and know how to do their jobs. You've got the location set up. Everything's already built out. But most importantly, you've got ongoing cash flow. So theoretically, you've got a practice that's already making good money after paying all the expenses, after paying the dentist. So that, you know, gives you some confidence that you're buying into a business that's already doing well. When you do a startup instead, obviously you have to start from the very beginning. You're starting from scratch. You're designing it. You're building it. It's not inexpensive to build out a practice. I mean, it's not hard to find a location. It's not hard to talk to your equipment sales rep and put in whatever nice new equipment you want. The problem is there's just not enough patients out there, and getting those new patients to come to the practice is a slow process. And I mean, Nick, I'm sure you get lots of phone calls from dentists like this. Yes. Who are looking to build up quickly. That's certainly where we see people struggle the most.
Yeah, I think that the way some people look at it is if you're evaluating buying a new practice, you're looking at, you know, how much am I paying per chart, right? So if the patient, like let's say the practice has 1,000 active patients, they kind of divide it in their head by, you know, what's the price per patient that I'm paying for. And generally, when you're buying a practice, that acquisition cost is much higher than if you look at how much does it cost for me to acquire patients if I just start from scratch and I do the marketing and I, you know, I don't buy an existing base. And generally, that's a lot lower. However, one thing that people don't factor in is that within that area, let's say 3, 5, 10 kilometers or miles around your office, there's only a small handful of people that are looking for a dentist or that are actually serious about going to one. Right, like most people either have a dentist or they don't want to go to the dentist. It's not like you're opening up a new restaurant where you put a bunch of balloons and a grand opening sign and everyone's going to show up. Like, there's not all that many people, so you might only be able to acquire 15, 20 patients every month in that area at a good acquisition cost. Now, how do you get more if you need more than that? Like, well, you generally spend more money, but the more money you spend on marketing, the less efficient it gets because you're reaching too many people. Maybe they're too far away, or they're patients who are searching things like cheap dentists near me. And normally you don't really want to advertise to people like that. But if you have, you know, pulled in all of the people that you can naturally pull in that are like good quality patients, and, you know, let's say that you only get to about 15, like how do I get to 30? Well, you loosen up your marketing, your targeting criteria, but then inevitably your costs will go up, and then you'll start getting more lower quality patients, people who like legitimately are kind of just price shopping around for the, you know, the cheapest dentist. And that's not ideal. The second thing is, while you might be able to acquire a patient for, let's say, $100, $200 using marketing, whereas if you have to buy the practice, you might be spending $500, $800, $1,000. Like, Jen, as a curiosity, like what is the average cost per chart in like Ontario as a, you know, ballpark?
I mean, it can vary. If you're buying charts in terms of a patient mover, and you're looking to buy charts from an existing practice to move them into your own, I mean, it can certainly vary, maybe anywhere between $200 and $700-$800 per chart. We've sold some for over $1,000 per chart, but those are, very unique circumstances. For a practice as a going concern, I mean, you're obviously getting the leaseholds and the equipment and everything as well. So, if you have a practice that is generating, call it $200,000 in EBITDA, your earnings after paying all the expense of the practice, after paying the dentist, that practice might be worth somewhere between a million, 1.2. But again, you've
Yeah,
got
so
ongoing cash
even
flow there.
yeah, even though like generally, theoretically speaking, you can acquire patients cheaper through marketing than you could through buying them. But one way to look at it as well is if you have running a practice is expensive. So you're paying your staff, you're paying the loan, the lease, it's expensive to run an office. So if you're running a deficit, like you're in the negative every month, even though you're acquiring patients for cheaper, you have to factor in what you're losing each month as well into your overall acquisition cost. And sometimes, like paying more, buying a practice with existing patients, you're able to get to, obviously get to profitability right away, but you're able to generate more money if you just like tweak that practice instead of starting it all from scratch. If you do start it from scratch, I mean, that could be quite lucrative, but generally, the timeline to from building something to strong profitability is a lot longer than most dentists realize, right? It's not going to be 3 to 6 months. It's not even probably not going to be a year either. It might be 2 years before you start to break even or make a little bit of a profit. It might be 3, 4 years before it really starts to do well. So if your horizon is you're looking at 5, 10 years, startup might be a great idea. But if you're thinking, I'm going to start it up, sprinkle a little bit of SEO and some Facebook advertising, and within 6 months I'll be doing great. Yeah, like you're setting yourself up for sort of a big headache.
And it's
But
also
I'm
about
curious.
timing too. I mean, certainly timing and quality of life. So if you're doing a startup, you need to have the time to work it. And the problem is it's a big investment. So if you're doing a startup and it's costing you somewhere between $600,000 and $1 million to build out this practice and you have no patients, you need to be open enough hours to attract those patients. But you likely also need to maintain an associate position to keep the money coming in because you're not making any money at the new practice as of yet. So we get lots of phone calls from dentists who say, I did this startup, but I still need to maintain 4 to 5 days a week working at my associateship, which means I'm not working at my practice and I'm paying someone at front desk to sit there and answer the phone and trying to work out a schedule where I can be there when I need to be, but also work at a job where I've got my guaranteed income. It becomes a very tricky thing to manage lifestyle.
Yeah, I've seen that with a number of practices where what hampers the growth is not only obviously it's tough to attract a high volume of patients when you're just starting out. You have no referrals you can count on because there's no existing patient base. But yes, they're spending 2, 3, 4 days a week in another practice, and then it becomes harder for them to even book patients because as a new patient, if I'm going to a dentist and they're really open 2 to 3 days a week, the thought running through my head is like, well, what if I ever need a Saturday appointment? Like, why don't I just go to the big office that seems to be open every day for 12 hours a day? So it kind of ends up being a bit of a hamstring. And you get it from the dentist perspective. It's like, well, I can't work full time in my office. There's just not enough cash flow. So it's a chicken and egg problem. It's like, well, you're not getting enough people because you're not there enough times. You don't have enough like availability in your schedule. And but they're not there because they don't have enough patients, right? So you kind of get into this like really negative spiral, and I've seen a lot of dentists kind of, pull their hair out and just say like, I just want to get rid of it. And I'm sure you get calls like this too. It's like, I tried it, it's too much of a headache, I want out. And then you're not selling under the most ideal circumstances,
No.
and that's not
And
great.
that's usually it. I mean, typically when we get those phone calls, it's a dentist who says, I need you to sell my practice. And we ask all of our normal questions and they say, well, it's pretty new. We set up 3 years ago. And as you get deeper into the conversation, you realize they've just had a real struggle getting new patients in. And so after 3 years, the bank is now collecting payments on the loan that they're not able to pay. They're paying a high amount of rent. They only have maybe a couple hundred patients. and they just can't make the numbers work. And it's a lot of effort to build it up. We've seen some do really well with startups, but unfortunately, that's not always the story for most people.
Yeah. Now, one thing we've heard a lot is people who do startups, and they say, like, look, I didn't build a startup because I thought this was the best way to go. I did want to buy an office. I mean, we were looking around for a while. I just haven't found one to purchase. So I'm curious, like, is there a lack of practices to buy? Is it something that's specific to, you know, certain states or certain provinces? Maybe there's a lack of thereof, or is it more of a problem of, you know, because my feeling was, are you being too picky? You know, are you looking for this sort of perfect practice that, you know, maybe doesn't exist, and you're passing by really good opportunities because you're hoping to find that perfect one, which, you know, like, it's not real. What's your thoughts?
It's a little bit of both. We're certainly in a seller's market where there's far fewer practices for sale than there are buyers. So I know there are a lot of buyers that do put their best foot forward trying to get a practice, and they legitimately come look at almost everything and submit LOIs on almost everything, and they still struggle to get one. That being said, more often is the case that it's just someone who is far too particular about the kind of practice they want. Everyone has an ideal practice in their mind, and as you said, there's no such thing as a perfect practice. So what we've started advising people is, listen, come up with your list of must-haves, come up with your list of nice-to-haves, and if you find a practice that ticks off most of your must-haves or all of your must-haves and some of your nice-to-haves, that's a good one to consider, because you'll never find the best practice. But, you know, aside from location, you can generally change a lot of things in a practice if it has a good cash flow. So certainly, you know, thinking about what's most important to you, what are the absolute deal breakers? You'd be blown away, Nick, by how many people want something that's, you know, I get a phone call. Okay, well, it has to be within this 4-block radius, and it needs to be retail ground floor location. And I want it to be an established practice that's been there forever, but all of the equipment and leaseholds are only 10 years old. And I want all the staff to know everyone really well and have contracts, but no one there long enough to result in a lot of termination if I let someone go. I mean, there's so many expectations.
right.
Practice doesn't exist. So, you know, at some point we start getting phone calls from the same buyer. Okay, it doesn't have to be within this 4-block radius anymore. Now we can consider a 1-hour radius of GTA, or then a 2-hour radius of GTA. And after a few years, it's, Jen, just find me a good practice with good cash flow and I'll move and I'll make it work. So ultimately, again, it just comes down to, what are the things that are deal breakers for you? And if you find a good practice with, you know, a great patient base, great cash flow, you can change almost anything else. If you want the brand new shiny office, don't turn down the older offices, because if they've got great cash flow, you can use that to renovate, to put in newer equipment, to put in a nice, you know, shiny new reception area. Whatever it is that you're looking to do, cash flow can resolve most of that. But if you're doing a startup with no patients, it's very hard to get that new equipment working for you to attract as many new patients as you need to pay off all the bills.
Now, we have a question in the chat, and I found this one actually quite interesting. What are your thoughts on what if it's an associate looking to become a partner in his existing practice? So, like, how does that work? Like, because at some stage you turn from partners to, there needs to be a negotiation of some sort. Obviously, that principal doesn't want to just, you know, give up, like, you know, what he's worked years for. So how does it work in that situation? Like, is there, you know, a buyer or like an agent representing the dentist who the you know, partner, like the associate who's looking to buy into the practice? Like, do you have a lot of experience on that front?
Yeah, it's a good question. We've certainly done a good share of buy-ins. Now, what I caution everyone to say is that you really need to know the person that you're getting into partnership with if that's what you want to do. It's, you know, a different situation if you're an associate and you want to fully buy out the practice that you're working with. It's a completely different story to say, I'm going to buy in and be a partner with my existing principal. Because the truth of the matter is, a lot of people think they want to get into a partnership because they have this idea that it's going to save them time. and have someone else there to help do all the work. In reality, you often work more because if it's your own practice, right. you can make all the decisions and decide what you want to do. When you're in a partnership, you always have someone else that you have to check every decision with. You want to open up later. Yeah. You want to, you know, buy new equipment. You want to do some new marketing. That's not all your decision anymore. You have a partner you have to consider as well. And it gets tricky, obviously, if two partners are different ages as well. If someone's closer to retirement yes. and the other one is a younger associate, the younger associate might want to spend more money to build out new things in the practice, whereas the retiring dentist just wants to run out their time and leave. They don't want to invest any more money because they're not going to be around for the benefit of it. So yeah. those are the kind of things. We see some partnerships work really, really well, and others are the reasons that we get phone calls saying you need to sell the practice or get me out right. because it's just not working the way they had hoped it would.
Yeah, I can, now that you bring up that point, you know, amongst the base of clients that we've worked with, there's been definitely a few where they were owned by multiple owners. And in almost every situation, it's like a disaster because like you said, they're different ages. They have different sort of goals. Even mm-hmm. if they have the same goals and the same vision in the beginning, people, their life circumstances change. So one dentist wants to do one thing, another wants to do another, causes a lot of tension. And I've heard this from a lot of dentists that were in this situation. You know, like if you go were to go back, would you still partner up? It's like, heck no. So, you know, yeah, I agree with you there. I think you need to really know that the person that you're getting in bed with, and oftentimes, it's better to be able to call the shots. It's better to be able to do things your own way because, you know, you remove a layer of, you know, complexity, confusion. Because like I said, even if you agree on, you have the same sort of vision when you start, things happen. People yeah. change. One partner gets sick. Or what you find is like one of them has a much stronger work ethic than the other. You know, and you know, sort of like resentment builds up from there. So I agree. I think yeah. it's much better to have a plan to say like, look, I want to fully buy this office and it's mine. And we kind of pass it over. And in the meantime, mm-hmm. you kind of work within and you know exactly like you're taking over something that you've worked in. So it's like, you know, getting into a brand new car. It is a bit weird the first time, right? When you buy a new office, if you are just taking over something you've been in for years, obviously it's a smoother transition with the staff as well, I assume. So yeah, if you have that opportunity, it's a great thing to explore, but I don't think every dentist necessarily wants a partner or wants to sell their practice, right? So they might not have the opportunity, you know, but it's worth exploring if wherever you're an associate, if the principal is you know, potentially willing to work with you for you to acquire the practice, that could be, you know, a fantastic opportunity. So Jen, I want to move on to, you know, the topic for tonight is, you know, the critical mistakes that dentists make when they're buying an office. And I kind of want to hear from you sort of like, what goes wrong? What are some of the mistakes that they make? And again, before I do that, I want to put up a quick poll because I'm curious to see from everyone, what do they think? You know, and we have options like maybe they buy a practice that's too small. Maybe they buy one that's too big. And maybe, you know, I'm actually curious because, you know, I'm not sure either. Like, I feel like all of these could be a problem. But I'm curious just to find out, yeah, what do you guys think is like one of the biggest mistakes someone can make? You know, are they buying too early in their career? Are they buying in the wrong area? Maybe it's too competitive, or, you know, are they buying a practice because it's close to their house? Or, you know, are they chasing profits and they're going somewhere where they shouldn't be because they think it's going to be more profitable? So, yeah, interested to see what everyone has to say here.
Yeah, I'm curious to see too.
So with the first poll, just to give you some results here, about 53% believe buying an existing practice is better. 30% think a startup is better, and the rest they're not sure. So yeah, like it's interesting. It's almost like people are sort of on the fence. Half of them believe that a startup, an existing practice might be better. The rest, maybe a startup, and some they're not 100%. So biggest mistake. Overwhelmingly, people believe it's buying a practice that's too large, followed by prioritizing personal location desires over practice suitability. So what are your thoughts? You've worked with hundreds of dentists. You've seen all the things that can blow up in their face? What are some big mistakes that they make?
Oh, I mean, we've seen a few, obviously. In my mind, some of the biggest ones they make when they're buying a practice is buying too big of a practice. But I'm going to preface that by saying this. When I say too big of a practice, I'm talking about taking on too much space. That's one of the big ones that we see. So certainly we see our number of dentists that get in trouble because they do a startup without any kind of clear plan as to how they're going to get enough patients to make it work. That's always a critical mistake. The second one is when doing a startup or when buying an existing practice, taking on way more space than is necessary. And it's more common in a startup than not. You'd be surprised how many phone calls I get for, appraisals and sales. And when we look at the numbers, they've, set up a 2,500 to 3,000 square foot facility. They have, 8 operatories set up, and if not all are equipped, but they still have the room for it. And they've only got maybe 1,000 patients. And you could certainly treat 1,000 patients in 1,200 square feet. You could fit 4 ops nicely into a 1,200 to 1,500 square foot facility. So you end up spending a lot of money on rent that otherwise would be going in your pocket and funding your lifestyle and doing a lot of other fun things with. So from my perspective, that's usually one of the biggest. In terms of buying too big of a practice, in terms of size, we generally don't see that being an issue. I mean, typically in our market, most practices are appraised and selling based on cash flow. And so I know a lot of dentists kind of get stuck in their mind in terms of affordability. But what they need to understand is that almost every practice, so long as it has good cash flow, is affordable. All the loans are paid out over a 12-year period. If you have a practice that's worth $1 million, you probably have cash flow, somewhere around $200,000 a year after paying all the expenses. If you have a practice at $3 million, that one probably has $600,000 in cash flow. So I think a lot of people kind of get stuck in this. Yeah, I mean, people get stuck in the mindset where if we have a practice for $1 million, they think that's a great deal and they think it's very affordable. And then they'll look at a $3 million practice and say, oh no, it's too expensive. But they're not looking at the cash flows and figuring out that the loans can both be paid off on the exact same timeline. It's just one, you've got much higher cash flows than the other. Everything else being equal.
Now, a question came up, and again, great questions, by the way, from everybody. But so this one is dealing with, what about attrition rate, right? What if you were to buy that $3 million practice? Obviously the $3 million comes from all the patients. And what if you suffer from a high attrition amount? Because hypothetically, let's say there is an attrition, if you could sell that practice for probably more than $3 million a year later, but what happens if you buy an office and find out that 30% of the patients decide to leave you? And, because I have seen that happen as well. What are your thoughts on that? Like, how do you deal with attrition?
It could certainly happen. I mean, there's no doubt in every single sale, there's going to be some attrition. And it really depends on the new purchaser and how their dental philosophy lines up with the previous dentist and how they run things. Mm-hmm. Typically if you kind of come into a practice and you watch and see how things go for the first year, you don't make any drastic changes and you don't push a lot of treatment on patients trying to, turn around your loan really quickly, generally right. You probably won't see that much patient attrition. Most patients are going to at least give you the benefit of the doubt for a visit with you. They're not going to leave immediately. So what I'd say is, so long as the philosophy is there, so long as you're, treating your patients well, we often don't see a ton of attrition when practice ownership changes hands. The ones where we have seen high attrition are generally when a new purchaser comes in and they make a lot of changes immediately. Maybe they're, really nervous about cash flow and they decide they want to terminate some staff to save some money. And that kind of creates an environment where patients are coming in, they're not seeing those same faces anymore. Maybe they're coming in and the new dentist is immediately trying to get them to take on high-end treatment that their previous dentist never even mentioned as an issue. That generally results in higher attrition. But if you come in and you're more conservative and get to know staff, get to know patients, and build up that trust and goodwill with them, you likely won't see as high attrition as some people think they might see. You also want to check the numbers too, right? I mean, obviously, if you're looking at a practice where the patient base has been declining year over year over year, naturally there's something going on and you might still continue to see that drop in the practice.
Interesting. So when we're talking about too big, what does that mean? Are you should they look at it in terms of how many operatories are there? They should look at, how do you identify if something's too big for you? Is it, it's doing too many treatments, there's too much staff to manage. What could be like an ideal practice size for, a dentist buying their first office? Would you advocate for more like buy a 3-4 operatory office, or is it better to buy one with 6 and kind of grow into it? How do you look at that when you're making that decision?
I think it generally depends on the purchaser and what they're looking to achieve. So if it's a dentist who prefers to be a solo practitioner, they don't want to work with associates, they just want a practice where they come in, they do the dentistry, they manage everything, you probably don't want something too big, because of course, as an owner operator, a good amount of your time is going to be managing the practice as well and handling staff, marketing, and all of these other issues. So you may want to limit yourself to, okay, I want a 3-4 op practice, maybe 1500 patients where I can keep myself relatively busy 4 or 5 days a week. And that's probably good enough. If you are a dentist who's more looking at this in terms of, well, I have a good associate position, I don't want to give it up, I just want to, get into the market, maybe then you want to look at a bigger practice that has GP associates that are doing the dentistry for you. If you're a dentist who just wants to kind of come in once a week or once every other week and do more of the higher end procedures, then you might be better off looking for a larger office with a larger patient base that gives you more opportunities to come in and do those kind of treatments on that patient.
Now, my theory, and correct me if I'm wrong, is I've seen practices or dentists who kind of go all in on the mega practice with 10, 12 operatories, and I feel like there's a lot of pressure to make it work, right? Because your expenses, even if you're only filling up 4 of the operatories, you're still paying the expenses to run that big of an office. So my thinking was always, it's better to daisy chain a few offices, like buy a 3-4 op practice, than, okay, I'm kind of outgrowing this place. Maybe open up a second one. Get an associate in the first one. So and maybe you bounce around between doing the more complicated procedures at each practice. You agree with that? Is that sound logic, or, are there economies of scale to build one big office? Because then you don't need 3 office managers. You have one. You don't need, so how do you, what's your thoughts on it based on like the success and failure you've seen in the industry over the last, decade or so?
Yeah, I mean, again, the biggest problems I've seen are the dentists that are doing a startup and they decide that, they've got visions of grandeur in their head and they set up a 6, 8, 10 op facility without having the patient base to fill it. And it takes a long time. Those ones, really struggle. It's a much better problem to have to start small with 3-4 ops and outgrow it, because as you said, you've got options there. The easiest one is to say, okay, well, We're maxed out. We've got 3-4 ops. We're using them all. You can always expand hours if you have the time in the schedule to open up more evenings or a weekend to treat more patients before you need to expand in terms of facility size. But as you said, okay, maybe then you start looking at buying another location somewhere, having a second practice. Maybe if your lease is coming up, if you think you're going to grow, if you want to move, if you have the cash flow that you think it's worthwhile to move into a bigger facility, maybe you just sell that practice and then get another one further away outside of your restrictive covenant and then start again. Okay. It's certainly a much better problem to have, to be outgrowing your space, than the reverse of just drowning in this large facility without having the cash flows to pay for it all.
So there's another good question in the chat here, and it kind of got me thinking a little bit, so they asked, how do you value an existing dental practice? And then I thought, Depending who buys it, the value is going to be different because it depends on what you can do with it, right? So I've heard some dentists say, like, when they're analyzing a practice, they're looking at, you know, hypothetically, there might be a practice that outsources all of their endo work. And it's like, well, if I do that, or I have some connections with, I have an associate that I can bring to this office too. You know, they do some calculations in their head that, you know, I can probably increase production by 5% just by introducing that service. Some of them don't do ortho, some of them don't do implants, right? So a practice is worth different amounts to different people. So when you're evaluating a practice and you're, you know, what would you look at, or what should a dentist look at where they might find some hidden potential there? Because it's not purely just cash flow, right? Like, that cash flow came as a result of the dentist who was running the business and the staff that were there, and you could do it differently. So what are some ways to look at, I guess, how do you uncover potential value that maybe doesn't show in the numbers, but, you know, like, there's opportunities here that we can quickly increase revenue. Obviously, cautioning them that if you buy the practice and start selling everybody like crazy and they just met you and you're already trying to push treatment on them, you're going to find your attrition rate goes through the roof. I've seen that happen. Yeah. So what are your thoughts? So what do you look at to uncover sort of like hidden value that other people may not see?
I think you've already kind of hit most of them on the head there, which is looking at the procedures that are currently being done in the practice and which procedures are being referred out. That's the biggest one. If you look at the tier three appraisals, we usually put together the revenue per patient per year charts that kind of show where the practice currently stands in terms of hygiene billings, dental billings, and lab. The dental billings per year charts, when they're at or below average, suggest a significant amount of upside for a new dentist who can come in, who can do some of those services that are currently leaving the practice. But as a purchaser, you do want to take a look, obviously, no matter what practice you're buying, at a report that shows the production by provider by code, just so you can see what is being done, how often it's being done, and really get a feel for what your level of billing is. And do you think you'll be able to at least maintain what's being done in the practice, if not add more services to do more? And as Nick said, I mean, certainly if you're comfortable doing ortho or endo or oral surgery, and you can see that those things are currently being referred out of the practice, you'll immediately be able to increase your revenue when you come in. So that's certainly one of the upsides you can look at. I've had other dentists who come in and they see upside if they're looking at a practice that's, you know, close to where they have a lot of friends and family. We get lots of purchasers that will come look at a practice and they'll say, well, I really like it because I have a practice and I'm currently, you know, out in Mississauga, but all my friends and family live in Brampton. And I know the second I buy a practice in Brampton, they're all going to come see me here because it's more convenient. So it's also about the number of patients they think they can bring with them, depending on where they're currently located and where they're going to be practicing.
Yeah, from a marketing perspective, I can tell you, you know, one thing I would look at is not just how many patients they're getting, but how many opportunities they're getting. Because what you'll often find is that there are a lot more leads and phone calls than what they're actually booking. So whenever we talk to new dentists, right, we ask them, like, hey, what is your staff's booking rate? And they say, oh, it's fantastic. It's like, okay. So what do you mean? What is the percentage? They don't have any percentage, right? They're not tracking anything. And we ask them, okay, well, let's say I get you 10 new patients calling. On average, how many do you think your receptionist would book into an appointment? Oh, 90%, right? So again, no data, no recordings, no, you know, but super, you know, for what they lack in metrics, they make up for with very strong opinions, right? When we start tracking all these stats for them, a lot of them are very shocked when they find that, no, it's not 90%, it's about 30%. And, you know, the first, you know, the staff will come up with excuses and say, oh, well, those patients weren't serious. They were price shoppers. They were this and that. But you'll find that, you know, we record, you know, hundreds of thousands of new patient calls a year from practices all across North America. I can tell you different offices handle the phone very differently. You know, like the same questions will come up, and what one office will say will be very different than another. And the results one office will achieve are very different than another. I talked about this with a dentist recently, and he had said, yeah, you know, like if I'm presenting treatment and I'm, you know, I look at someone and I I noticed that they need Invisalign. My acceptance rate might be 70-80%. But if my associate has that patient, their acceptance rate might be 20%. And it's like, well why? It's like, well, many reasons. Sometimes they're afraid to present treatment. They look at the patient and say, oh, I don't think they can afford it. I shouldn't even bring it up. It's like, whereas the other dentist, his viewpoint is, it's not my place to judge what you can and can't afford. I'm here to give you, you know, good advice and lay down your options and help you understand the pros and cons between everything. And I'll let you make the decision you think is best. If it was me, I think it's worth doing this treatment. I think this, there's a lot of upside to it. You know, so they'll have different sort of philosophies. And I think people, when you're looking at, you know, a financial report, you're looking at a what's happened, not the, what the potential is there necessarily, right? It's like, this is the result of the people who work there and the and how they've run things. I would be curious, like if I was a dentist and I was buying a practice, I'd be curious to, if you can get your hands on data, like how many people are actually calling this place? Because what you may find is that the reason they're booking 10, 15 patients a month isn't because there aren't people calling. Maybe they just don't know how to handle it really well. And very quickly you can kind of turn things around. Or I would, you know, even try to figure out, you know, are you not booking more because your hours of operation are really weird? Like, you know, you never have a day where you're open late or something like that. I would try to find, you know, there's a difference between them booking 15, 20 a month if they get 25 phone calls. But there's also a realistic situation where it's like there may be a practice that gets 100 phone calls, but they only book 25 because they just don't have the right people at the front desk. And if you swap that around, actually you can, you know, get some results sort of quite quickly. But I'm curious, like when you know, on the last webinar, so for anyone who's missed it, the last webinar we covered how to sell a practice. You know, what do you do the couple years before you're looking to sell to kind of get the numbers just right and maximize the value of the sale? And one thing that Barb talked about was that, you know, there's ways to not lie, but you can massage the data to tell a good story, okay? And I'm curious that, you know, you're representing them on from a different angle when you're buying, is that you're trying to catch a story that's too good to be true in some respect, right? Where it's like, there's something fishy in these numbers, right? It's, yeah, they were doing, you know, let's say 800,000 in production, all of a sudden 2 years before they're selling, they're at, you know, 1.3 million, like, you know, this is a bit odd. What should you look for that might, you know, to you, someone with experience in the industry could identify, like, maybe, you know, these numbers look a little suspect, okay? You know, like you said, it's like, what if they're pushing a lot of treatment and patients are, you know, there's about to be a mass exodus here, right? What have you noticed when you're evaluating practices that your clients want to buy that, you know, might bring up some red flags for you?
I mean, it's not necessarily that we find things that are suspect. It's more, I mean, we're obviously very data driven. So as we said before, the things that a purchaser should be looking at really does come down a lot to, okay, what is the revenue being done? What is that made up of in terms of what kind of procedures are being offered? Am I comfortable that I'm going to be able to maintain that level of dentistry? I mean, certainly if you look at the revenue and you can see that the dentist is doing a ton of ortho in-house, and if you as the buyer are not at all comfortable doing Invisalign or braces, this might not be the one for you, because you're going to have to either refer that out or bring someone else in and pay them to do that work. You know, similarly looking at the patient count, and it's not enough to just get what is the total number of current patients. You want to see what the history is. Has the patient base been growing? Have they been declining? Is there a huge attrition issue? Is there a really large attrition issue, maybe because the current dentists are pushing too much treatment on their patients and they're treating it like a factory and everyone's leaving? Are they losing patients maybe because they've lost a key hygienist in the last year and they're trying to figure that out? So all those kind of details can obviously make a big difference. But that being said, I think there's also still a lot of really good opportunities coming up. The one big issue that we're seeing across the board seems to be more often than not lease issues. And that's certainly something that purchasers should be looking at when they're getting into a practice, because while historically, probably 15, 16 years ago when I first got into this, we were seeing, you know, some kind of demolition or termination clauses in maybe one out of every 10 leases. I bet it's getting closer to 50% right now. And in some areas, we're actually seeing buildings that are coming down. Our clients are getting notifications that the building is coming down and they've got to move the practice. So I think certainly for some entrepreneurial dentists who are looking to maybe do a little bit of both in terms of starting up their own practice, but want the benefit of existing patients, there's going to be some areas, you know, particularly in Brampton right now, where you could theoretically find a good location, build something out. And my guess is in the next several years, you'll find yourself a lot of patient bases coming up for sale from all the other units that are coming down that you could merge and essentially make a really nice practice into. On the same note, as I'm sure Barb had said in her talk, you want to make sure you are backed by people in the dental industry who know what they're doing. So have a good dental accountant behind you, have a good dental lawyer behind you, a banker who can help you look at numbers. Because most of us sales reps focus solely on the vendor. We don't represent the buyer. It's just the seller side. So you'll want to use your advisors to make sure you're getting the right advice. We've seen some really great accountants that can walk their clients through the numbers and say, you know, this is a great practice, but this is not the right one for you. And this is why. And similarly, those same accountants will tell their clients, this practice is amazing, and here's why you should buy it. Because as you said, Nick, they're referring out 10 oral surgeries a month and 15 ortho cases a month. And I know you can do all of these things. So your revenue is going to be up here, even though their current practice is down here. So there's a number of different things, obviously, to take into consideration when you're looking to buy a practice.
Yeah, from sort of our perspective, like the more marketing patient acquisition type perspective, I would caution a lot of dentists to, you know, I would advise them to spend a lot more time researching the competition in that area, because we've had cases come up. Like, for example, we had a recent call with a dentist out west in, you know, bought a practice in a small town, and very quickly in the conversation it became apparent in his head, he felt like no one's doing anything out here. Competition's really weak. The marketing is going to be super easy. You know, and we, I had asked them, it's like, what makes you say that? And his view was, well, it's a small town. There's not a whole lot of dentists here. They're all old. None of them are doing anything. They don't understand what the internet is all about. And he was really shocked when I showed him, like, I pulled up a Google Analytics report. And we measure, you know, what does it cost to advertise in different parts of the country, right? So I said, you know, I don't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but to give an example, let's say in Toronto, it was, you know, if you want to advertise for dental implants, maybe it was, let's say it was $5 a click. In this particular town, it was $12. And I told them, I was like, what you're not looking at here is you bought here because you felt like it's all a bunch of old dentists who are retiring. They don't know anything. They don't even know how to use a cell phone properly. I'm going to dominate them all, right? And 10 other young dentists, just like you, thought the same thing. And they also bought offices here. So in fact, no, they're not owned by old people. You know, and when I pulled up the websites, I showed him, like, look, this one's taken over by someone that's your age. And he definitely knows how to use Google, right? So you can't, it's very important to look at who you're competing against. Because obviously you're competing it with these people to try to attract those patients. You want to get more patients, so do they. You know, that's the lifeblood of the business. There's always going to be attrition. You know, a good 5%, 6%, 7% of people will leave every year because people move, people die, you know, things happen. So everyone needs to get more patients. And there's a lot of towns where when the dentist started that business, you know, there was maybe four other dentists that they're competing with. And today there's 24, and they all want to get more patients. And the population didn't go up five times. Okay. It went up 20%. So I'm always shocked how, you know, every state and every province will have a governing board, and generally there'll be a database with, you know, who are all the dentists in every single town and city. And, you know, I've always been shocked whenever I've asked people, like, don't you look at that data? Like, how many people live in that town versus how many active dentists are practicing, and look at the ratio. What's the ratio if you look at this town? What's the ratio of this area? And I've never had one that looked at any of that data. And it's like, it's all publicly available. Just look at it. Because what you'll see, you know, I'll use Ontario as an example, because, you know, that's where we started years ago. You know, I showed one dentist, like, look, there's about 1,300 people for every dentist in this province. Okay. Now, not every one of these people is a potential patient, because some of them are 1 year old and 2 year olds. You know, they're not decision makers. Some people are old. By the time the census was done, some of them have passed away, right? So not all of them want to go to the dentist. Some of them already have dentists, but it gives you an idea of like how much potential opportunity is there, how many fish are in this pond, and how many fishermen am I competing against to try to attract these people. There were areas where, you know, there might be 2,200 people for every dentist, and other areas where there were 500 people for every dentist. I'm sure you won't be shocked to hear that, like, when we look at the data, the ones that were in, you know, much more competitive areas, it's a lot more expensive to get a patient. So if the the practice was in an area with 2,200 people per dentist, maybe the acquisition cost of each new patient was $75. If they were in an area that was 500 people for every dentist, the acquisition cost was like $400, right? So it's worth doing a little bit of research on who are you going up against. Again, you could always look at the ratios by comparing population to dentists. This doesn't always give you the full picture, though, because sometimes you could have a lot of dentists in the area, but they really aren't doing anything all that great. They don't have good Google reviews. Yeah. They don't have a good website. And sometimes you can be in a small town where actually there's a bunch of young dentists that are very marketing savvy and tech savvy, and they're doing a lot of good things. So it's worth like Googling that area and looking at who ranks really well. How mm-hmm. good does their website look? Do they have testimonial videos? Do they have reviews? Because if you're in an area where the top review dentist has 80 reviews, I mean, we can beat that person. We could very quickly get you 100, 200, 300 reviews, you know. But there's towns where, or towns and cities where the top dentist has 1,200 reviews. The next one has like 800. The next one has 400. Like, and you're buying a practice that has 30 reviews, and a lot of them are negative because the dentist who's selling it, you know, wasn't doing a great job. People didn't really like them. And you've got an uphill battle when it comes to sort of like the PR of it, right? So many ways to look at it, you know, but I definitely agree with your point that you want to build a good team that can advise you well. You know, a good broker, a good accountant, a good lawyer. And like I said, a lot of the reason the startups don't work is because they just don't have a very good plan for how they're going to acquire patients. So usually they involve the marketing company after they bought it. So it's like they already shot themselves in the foot, and now they're seeking help a little bit too late.
Well, it's what you said earlier too, right? About how people handle the phone calls. I mean, I think there's a lot of purchasers that expect the location to do all the work for them. So they want to buy this, you know, ground floor retail location, and they just expect that they're going to be getting 40, 50 new patients a month. And when that doesn't transpire, they don't understand what went wrong. But you know, there's much more to having a great location. As you said, you still have to work for it. And it's about how your staff is trained to answer the phone calls and what marketing avenues you're taking to get new patients. Some of the strongest new patient flows I've seen, two of them have been in a practice that was in an upper floor of a professional building, had absolutely zero to do with the location. But they just had really good plans in place, a well-trained team. It was a well-oiled machine. They knew exactly what they were doing, and they got a fantastic new patient flow in a location that most purchasers would have on their absolute no list, because they assume being in a professional building means no walk-ins, no new patients, I'm not going to do well. And that's not at all the case.
Yeah. Yeah. So we have a question here. This is a more marketing related. So is direct mail better than digital marketing, or should you have a mix of both? So generally speaking, I mean, digital marketing is going to be superior because it's the cost to reach a person is a lot cheaper. So when you're spending money on flyers, you're basically spending a lot of money on paper, throwing it around the neighborhood and hoping somebody like looks at it and decides to buy. You're trying to kind of find a needle in the haystack. A lot of the time, you know, when you go to your mailbox, there's a million flyers in there. And I know when I was, you know, downtown Toronto, there was a huge recycling bin in the mail room, and everybody just took their mail, took all the flyers, threw them directly in the garbage, didn't even look at them once. And you're paying for all of that, right? So when you're doing digital marketing, you're only paying when someone is actually engaged and clicks on the ad and goes to the website. So imagine it's almost like it's a flyer that if the person throws in the garbage, it doesn't cost you anything. In fact, even if they look at it and they're like, yeah, it's not for me, and they don't take it inside, it's also free, right? So essentially, it's cheaper to reach people. Most people these days, you know, they're going to go online and they're going to look for, you know, what are my options? We don't live in the yellow page days where if you have a problem, you go through a book or you find a flyer that says, oh, this person offers plumbing, I need a plumber, let me call. These days, people generally want to do their research before calling anybody. They'll go online. I would say better than, you know, your question was like, should you do a mix of both? I would say it's better to do one thing, even if it's flyers, and just do that really, really well instead of trying a million different things and kind of doing a half-assed job at all of them, right? Because a lot of dentists, they take this approach of, I don't know what's going to work, so let me experiment. I'll try a little bit of this, I'll try a little bit of that. If I see that I'm getting good results, I'll do more of that activity. If it's not generating results, you know, I'll do less of it, or I'll cut it off. And what they find in 99% of cases is nothing works. And it's not that what they're doing is wrong. It's that they basically do a half-assed job. And I've told a lot of dentists, like, you know, let's say we propose like, hey, let's do some SEO. Let's do this sort of strategy. Oh, no. I've tried that before. You know, I spend money on Facebook. It didn't work. And I tell them, it's like, yeah, because you didn't do a good job at it, right? So, and some of them get a little offended, and I have to, you know, sort of like pause and like, hey, look, I'm not trying to be rude, but like, let's be honest here. When you look at your flyer, when you look at your Google campaign, what was amazing about it? Like, were you really the best in the area at doing this? Like, was, you know, is your website better than every other dentist? Are your reviews better? Is your flyer like amazing? And they'll say, well, no, I mean, it's not like, wasn't the best, but it wasn't terrible. And I'm like, yeah, it wasn't at the bottom, and it definitely wasn't at the top either, which means it's somewhere in the middle, right? That's what you call the halfway point, right? That's what it means to do a half-assed job. And what happens is we live in a world where putting 50% of the effort into something is not going to get you 50% of the results. It's not going to get you any results, okay? Because nobody celebrates the 10th place winner of a race. Okay. The first guy gets, you know, the trophy, the prize money, the fame, the glory, you know, second place still gets something, obviously not as much as first. Third place is okay. What happens to the person who came in 11th? You get a pat on the back, right? So I would say whatever strategy you pick, whether it's flyers, whether it's digital, just stick with one thing and commit to being world-class at it. Do a better job than everybody in your area. And if you decide that, like, hey, I don't think I can do a better job at, you know, SEO, because there's some company, like some dental practice, they're spending thousands of dollars, I don't have that kind of budget, maybe we can be number one at reviews or something like that. Like, pick something that you think you can do a better job than everybody at, and stick with that. And then once that kind of like works at its peak, then maybe move on to a second activity, rather than sprinkling your money, trying 50 different things, hoping something's going to click and then magic's going to happen. So that's my advice. It's not so much, is direct mail better? Is digital marketing better? The question is, like, how well do you do it? If you gave me only flyers, like you gave me a practice and you said, all you can do in terms of marketing is old paper-based methods from the 50s. I would still beat you if you're, you know, sprinkling your money on 50 different things. So that's more important. The other thing is, have a good way to track it, right? So most clients, when we, you know, they'll spend a couple thousand dollars on flyers, and I ask them, so what came out of that? Like, what's the return on investment? And they'll say, oh yeah, it worked. We got a couple patients out of it. It's like, how many? 5, 10, 20? Oh, I'm not really sure, but yeah, we saw some results. And then when we measure it for them, we show them, like, no, you spent $3,000 on flyers and you got 6 phone calls. So that's $500 a phone call. And that didn't result in 6 patients. It resulted in 2 patients. So of the 6, only 2 came in. So that's $1,500 a patient. And those patients only spent like $800 with you. So actually, you're spending like a dollar Like you're spending a dollar to get a return of like 60 cents back. Like this isn't a good strategy. So in marketing, before you do any marketing, whether it's flyers or whatever, it doesn't really matter. Have a good way that you're going to track what the results are going to be so that you don't get bamboozled by people. So hopefully that helps. But on our YouTube channel, we have a ton of videos about like different marketing options. I would say everything can work. It just comes down to how well you do it. With that, I will leave it open for questions. If anyone else has any questions, if we can't get to them, we will definitely make sure that we'll answer it in email after the fact. Jennifer, what's the best way that people can get in touch with you? So let's say they're, you know, apprentice, an associate. They're looking maybe to buy a practice. They're looking to sort of make this leap. How can they get in touch with you to start that conversation and start exploring where they might be able to buy a practice?
Yeah, I mean, certainly they can go to our website, reach out to any of the sales reps that are on there. We would recommend that they register with Tier 3 so that they get automatic emails every time a new listing goes live to give them access to everything on the market. So the website is www.tier3.ca. We're now a Henry Schein company as well, so they're free to reach out to me directly with any questions, jennifer.blair@henryschein.ca.
Perfect. And for our American dentists out there, you know, being part of the Henry Schein umbrella, I'm sure you'd be able to connect them with, you know, the sort of sister company in the US as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Fantastic. Well, Jen, thank you so much. I'll leave it open for another minute or so if there's any other questions. There was one that I missed here. So when you're valuing existing practice, you know, I've seen the rule of thumb is 0.6 to 0.8 times gross revenue. Is that true? Like how, I'm assuming it's based more than just revenue, right? Like you do have to take a look at what are you buying? What equipment is there? You know, but yeah, can you give us some thoughts on like beyond just revenue, kind of like what goes into that evaluation?
Yeah, and the truth of the matter is looking at a practice based solely on revenue is a terrible way to value a practice because your top line revenue isn't what matters. It's your bottom line of what comes out. It's the net cash flows coming out of the practice after paying all of your expenses that is the amount of money you're going to be using to pay back the loan and what you're going to be using to fund your lifestyle. So I generally don't look at practices in terms of values as a percent of revenue. The range is too wide. We've certainly seen practices sell for 50% of gross revenue. We've seen practices sell for well over 200% of gross revenue. So not a great measure. The standard in Ontario and generally across Canada is in terms of a multiple of projected earnings. So typically what we've seen recently, also given the higher interest rates at play, has been somewhere between 5 and 6.5 times earnings. Give or take, some go up to, you know, 7 times, a little bit over 7 times projected earnings. Some go for less. It depends on each individual practice, obviously, and the challenges or opportunities it might have. So does it have a strong cash flow? Is there any ethnicity skew in the patient base? Are they writing off the copay? Is it a declining patient base? Are there lease issues? There's, I mean, a ton of different factors that go into determining the value.
Yeah, I think the, you know, like the common answer is it depends, right? So yeah. I think probably the biggest takeaway for me during this talk was that, you know, you really have to understand where you bring value, because if you take that same dentist and you plant them into different offices, one of them they could be a complete failure in, and another one they could really turn it around and turn it into a huge success. So you really need to look at like, what are your strengths and what do you bring to the table, and work with somebody that can help you understand like you said, like this is not the right one for you. It might be right for many other dentists, but for you in these situations and what we know about what your goals are and how you want to proceed, you're going to land yourself in a lot of hot water trying to do this. Because like some areas are more susceptible, you know, if you're trying to push a lot of like cosmetic dentistry or things like that. I mean, if you're in, let's say, hypothetically, a bigger city where you have younger crowd, they do care about their appearance, like that might work. You try to do that in a small town, where like you're gonna have a lot of patients leaving because, you know, and you see it in the reviews. It's like, oh, Dr. Smith was amazing, and ever since he retired, this new guy who took over, he's just trying to like upsell me on everything. And you know, you can get into a lot of trouble. So I would say, yeah, really understand what you bring to the table, understand mm-hmm. like what value each practice has to you, what could you do with it? And you touched upon this earlier. It's like, have a really good game plan for how you're going to attract patients. Don't just buy something and then now let's look for some marketing. It's like, it doesn't work like that. Yeah. Right?
And I mean, on that note, know what you're buying. So make sure that you're doing your proper due diligence on how many patients there actually are. You don't want to rely on a vendor's estimate, because every time that we ask clients, most of them don't know. Most of them don't know. And truth of the matter is, depending on what software you have in the practice, you can get a different answer too. There's lots of reports out there that will show total active patients in the practice. But if your front desk hasn't been actively removing patients when they ask for a records transfer, when they move away, that number is going to be much more inflated than what your actual 12-month patient count is who've actually shown up and paid for treatment. So there's a big difference between active patients in the software versus your ongoing recurring patients that are coming in frequently.
I've seen that happen, because sometimes, you know, there's that concern of like high attrition. And I think what some people don't realize is like, it's not that there's high attrition. A lot of the people that you thought you bought, they weren't real. This person had been around for a long time, right? So you're right. Yeah. Like RevUp, like we go into a lot of patient management systems to do like financial reports to show them like, you know, has the marketing generated a good return on investment? How much has your revenue grown? And often you will find that it's a mess. Like the things aren't being tracked correctly. There's no notes. There's, you know, there's a lot that isn't done well. And to the defense of the staff, like, I mean, each of these systems can be quite complex, quite, you know, cumbersome. You might have a receptionist that came from using, you know, AbleDent for years, and then now she's on Dentrix or EagleSoft or something. Like, they don't know. Mm-hmm. So actually this question came up. So as a buyer, do you need to have an appraisal done again, or depend on the seller agent's appraisal?
I mean, I guess it kind of depends what situation you're in. So typically if you're bidding against other people trying to buy a practice, you're likely not going to have the time or the opportunity, nor will you want to spend the money to have your own appraisal done. Because whatever brokerage you engage to do that appraisal for you is going to need the vendor's cooperation to get full information, to lock into their software, to get patient counts and financials, et cetera. And if they've engaged a different brokerage, they're not going to want to spend the time to allow you that same opportunity. So you want to make sure that when you're looking at the appraisal, that generally the numbers make sense. Again, if you're working with a really good dental accountant, dental lawyer, dental banker, they'll be able to help you. So, I mean, you will be able to see things. I mean, if you take a look at the numbers and you say, okay, well, they're grossing, you know, $500,000, but they say they've got 4,000 patients. Well, that doesn't make sense. We know they don't have 4,000 patients. So, you know, it's things like that you want to be leery of. But certainly if everything looks good and you make an offer, you'll all have an opportunity to go in and complete your due diligence. So at the due diligence stage, really make sure you get a feel for how many charts there are, how many patients have come in on a 12-month basis, how many are hygiene versus new patients versus emergencies, what treatments are being provided, what's the age of the patients. There's a number of things. Yeah.
Fantastic. Okay, so we'll wrap it up there. If you guys have any questions, again, I definitely recommend reaching out to Jennifer. We've known each other for a couple of years now. It's definitely a huge wealth of information. And I think what I like with Tier 3 is that they have a lot of data to compare what looks normal, what metrics are kind of out of place. I think we've learned a lot, you know, from RevUp side, trying to see like what happens behind the scenes. What is a normal hygiene percentage amount? What, like, how can you tell if maybe the expenses that a particular practice has, like, are too high or too low? They're kind of like the counterpart. Like, we look at all the marketing things, how their staff handle calls, and how do you, you know, present treatment better? How do you get a higher conversion rate? They're looking at things from a more internal perspective, which I think is arguably a lot more important. Highly recommend reaching out to them. I think it'd be in great hands with Jennifer. But thank you so much for taking the time to do this. This was incredibly helpful, and I hope everyone got a lot out of this. All right, take care, everyone. Thank you for joining us tonight, and see you on the next one.